When we last saw Clarence Ziegfeld a week ago, he was enjoying the success of the 1919 Ziegfeld Follies, a show which will always be remembered for the tune which Irving Berlin wrote for it, A Pretty Girl Is Like a Melody. Ziegfeld was also enjoying, as usual, the loving attention of a set of ladies whose affection for him was markedly more in evidence than any affection they might have felt for each other. The central figure in this melodrama was Mrs. Ziegfeld, the talented comedienne Billy Burke. In his own peculiar way, Ziegfeld seems to have loved her. She certainly loved him, but sadly, not always with the happiest results. For instance, after Anna Held and Lillian Lorraine had barnstormed their way out of his life, he became involved with a chorus girl called Olive Thomas. But it seems that neither Billy Burke, nor Anna, nor Lillian, nor even Olive was the great outstanding passion of his life. That honour went to yet another lady of the musical theatre, and to follow the plot becomes a shade involved. Olive Thomas became disenchanted when Flo started dating her girlfriend, one Anna Daly. So, Olive went and left the Follies and got involved with an actor called Jack Pickford. In 1917, Olive became Mrs. Pickford. And that was the year Ziegfeld put on the musical called Miss 1917 with a Victor Herbert hit called Kiss Me Again. While Kiss Me Again and Miss 1917 drifted on into 1918, Flo fell in love with a 19-year-old dancer called Marilyn Miller. One biographer has described Marilyn's chief asset as a ruthless charm, and the facts seem to bear that out. She became the big hit of the 1918 Follies in spite of the fact that her talent was modest. Then she fell for one of the cast, Frank Carter, and threw a bracelet that Flo had given her at his head. Frank was then sacked by Flo and went and got killed in a car smash. That left Flo and Marilyn temporarily without complications. Well, comparatively speaking. The next thing Flo did for Marilyn was to set up a new show for her. It was called Sally, and it had a hit with music by Jerome Kern and words by P.G. Woodhouse.
Shine for you a heart full.
I wonder what Plum thought of Ziegfeld.
I think we were characters in those days. I mean, people like Ziegfeld. When I was starting, they were men who knew their business. I mean, Ziegfeld, Dillingham, Comstock, they all knew their business.
The reviews for Sally were ecstatic, and the show did more than any other to make Marilyn Miller a big Broadway star. But Flo Ziegfeld still kept his follies going, the ones on stage, that is, and was still wrestling with the problem of trying to assess the merits of comedians who didn't make him laugh. Arthur Schwartz remembers.
He knew a great deal about costumes and girls and scenery, and he knew practically nothing about comedy. There's one story I know about that illustrates his not being a good judge of comedy. J.P. McAvoy, who became a successful playwright and sketch writer, gave to Ziegfeld a sketch which was all pantomime, no dialogue. It was for W.C. Fields. And the setting was the fire escape of a four-story building. And W.C. Fields was on the third or fourth story and was sleeping out because it was so hot on this fire escape with ladders that went from floor to floor. And it's about 5 o'clock in the morning, and he's trying to get sleep. And the scene was simply a pantomime of all the things that prevented his sleep. The milkman going up and down, the babies crying, and all that. It was embroidered with a lot of real things that happened and identifiable to all the audiences. Well, Ziegfeld read this script and said, "It won't go. It's not funny. The audience won't like it," he said to McAvoy, who told me this story. And McAvoy said, "Try it." He said, "It's a very expensive set, that goddamn thing. I'm not going to spend the money." He did spend the money. And on the opening night, McAvoy and Ziegfeld were in the back of the New Amsterdam Theater. And this sketch came on. And the audience absolutely roared at every moment, just what the author would want. And finally, when all the laughter and applause subsided, McAvoy said, "The audience loved it. What do you say, Ziggy?" Ziggy said, "They weren't on the level."
The amazing thing is that in spite of Flo Ziegfeld's dilatory way with the comedian and his persistent habit of falling in love with actresses and dancers, people generally tended to flock to be in his shows. And some idea of the aura that surrounded his reputation can be sensed from the testimony of yet another singer-dancer whose chance came when Ziegfeld spotted her. The name is Ruby Keeler.
Of course, Mr. Ziegfeld, that was the top. He was a wonderful, wonderful man to work for, and I don't think he missed a show. The reason I say that, he was the type of man that would always send a note back, you know. If the performance happened to be a little better than another performance, he would say so. Then he'd also send beautiful presents, flowers and stockings and just beautiful things.
In the first show Ruby Keeler did for Ziegfeld, she danced and Eddie Cantor sang.
Another bride, another groom, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee. The choir sings, here comes the bride, another victim is by her side. He's lost his reason, 'cause it's the season for making whoopee. Down through the countless ages, you'll find it everywhere. Somebody makes good wages, somebody wants her share. She calls him Toodles and rolls her eyes. She makes him strudels and bakes him pies. What is it all for? It's so he'll fall for making whoopee. Another year, or maybe less. What's this I hear? Well, can't you guess? She feels neglected, and he's suspected of making whoopee. She sits alone most every night. He doesn't phone or even write. He says he's busy, but she says, is he? He's making whoopee. He doesn't make much money, $5,000 per. Some judge who thinks he's funny says you pay six to her. He says, now judge, suppose I fail. The judge says, budge, right into jail. You'd better keep her. You'll find it's cheaper than making.
Eddie Cantor, who perhaps of all Ziegfeld's associates had the oddest relationship of all. Cantor was supposed to be funny, and that meant by definition that Ziegfeld would hate his act, which he did. Cantor had first worked for Ziegfeld in the 1917 Follies, and eventually was to be the only artist ever to get star billing in a Follies production. Cantor and Ziegfeld had a sort of friendship going in the end, a sort of mutual detestation society flecked with grudging affection. Flo even allowed Cantor to call him Flo, which was a very rare privilege indeed, as Keenan Wynn knows.
You know, it always used to make my father so furious when people would say Ziggy or Flo, because you'd never said that any more than you said Louie or LB. Speaking about Mr. Mayer, he was Mr. Mayer and he was Mr. Ziegfeld. And my dad was his partner and called him Mr. Ziegfeld. Mr. Ziegfeld would call him Eddie, but you didn't do that with those kind of people.
Keenan's father, of course, being Edwin, one of Ziegfeld's stars and associates. There were moments when people called the great man neither Ziggy or Flo nor Mr. Ziegfeld, but some rather more colourful name, which we can't repeat here. But people like Cantor, men with genuine talent, which Ziegfeld sensed, though he couldn't define it, battled through to a genuine association with him. When Ziegfeld first put Cantor into a star role in a show called Kid Boots, there was a general feeling in the camp that the show lacked one big potential hit song. At the last minute, they found a likely item. Cantor liked it, the director liked it, even Flo liked it.
Carolina gave me Dinah. I'm the proudest one beneath the Dixie sun. News is spreading about the wedding. I hear church bells ringing. Here's the song my heart keeps singing. Dinah, is there anyone finer in the state of Carolina? If there isn't, you know her. Show her to me or Dinah. With her Dixie eyes blazing, how I love to sit and gaze in through the eyes of Dinah Lee. Every night, why do I shake with pride? Because my Dinah might change her mind about me. Dinah, if she wandered to China, I would hop an ocean liner just to be with Dinah Lee.
If the market takes another slump, I know thousands and thousands of married men who will have to leave their sweethearts and go back to their wives. Nowadays, when a man walks into a hotel and requests a room on the 19th floor, the clerk asks him, for sleeping or jumping?
Dinah, is there anyone finer in the state of Carolina? If there isn't, you know her, or show her to me, hot Dinah. With the Dixie eyes blazing, how I love to sit and gaze in to the eyes of Dinah Lee. Every night, why do I shake with pride? Because my Dinah might change her mind about me. Dinah, if she wanted to China, I would
would hop an ocean liner
just to be with Dinah Lee.
Eddie Cantor and Dinah are synonymous, but it's generally forgotten today that it was a Flo Ziegfeld production that brought the star and the song together. Another big hit around which a legend has accumulated is a number by the Gershwin brothers called Liza, which Ruby Keeler was given to sing at that time. But let her tell the story as it really happened and why it happened, instead of the usual Hollywood-type romantic version. For one thing, it's much funnier this way.
We opened in New York, and I didn't sing Liza because I don't sing. I really haven't any voice, but I was to dance, and it was a great big set. It was like minstrel with tambourines and whatnot. And the opening night, I came down the stairs. I was at that time married to Al Jolson, and he was in the audience, and while I was dancing, he just stood up and sang Liza. To the delight of the audience.
At this point, it's interesting to cast the mind back for a moment to the famous scene in the movie The Jolson Story, where Al sings Liza purely out of the goodness of his husbandly heart to help his brave little wifey through her terrible ordeal. Well, this is what poor little wifey has to say about that.
I know that they did do it in the movie. I haven't seen the movie, but the way I understand it, they said that I was fainted or I was getting dizzy, but that wasn't true at all. I didn't think it was a very nice thing to do, because it was not his show, and he was not in the show. There were other people in the show that, you know, that were doing pretty well. I don't think Mr. Ziegfeld was probably delighted, because it got great press, you know. It was such an unusual thing to happen.
Liza, Liza, skies are gray, but if you smile on me, all the clouds roll away. Liza, Liza, don't delay. Come keep me company and the clouds roll away. See the honeymoon shining down. We should make a date with Parson Brown. Liza, Liza, name of the day. When you belong to me, and the clouds roll away.
I don't know what ever possessed him to do it. Only, knowing him, I think probably he wanted to be part of that night. I don't think it was anything else but that.
Liza, Liza, name of the day. When you belong to me, all the clouds will roll.
It sounds like it was Al Jolson's opening night too, but some of the other performers of the period appeared for Ziegfeld in a more orthodox way, including Fanny Brice. She maintained her association with Ziegfeld through the 20s, and early in the decade she hijacked a song Flo intended for another singer. One of his tactics was the visit to Europe in search of suitable material. An odd thing to do, really, with the golden age of American songwriting flourishing right under his nose, but Flo Ziegfeld liked Europe. One of his favorite actresses, Claire Luce, cast some light on that.
Well, Ziegfeld used to spend a lot of time in Paris where the women on the stage were topless, as they call it. I don't think Ziegfeld would allow the sex act on the stage in his productions for the simple reason that pulchritude, beauty, and all the words he used were part of an artistic sense that he had innately. I don't think he wanted shock value so much as beauty. I think he wanted to create beauty. And if there happened to be beauty in anything that pertained to sex, I don't suppose he would draw any bars, but somehow it's pornography. And can be free or it can be nasty. It's the attitude. I don't think it has so much to do with morals as taste.
Well, one manifestation of Ziegfeld's taste in these matters was his liking for a French song which he brought back to New York with him with a certain singer in mind. But when Fanny Brice heard the song, she insisted on doing it, even though, or perhaps because, it meant stepping out of her ragged clown character and dressing up in high style. The song became the biggest hit of her life.
I love him so. He'll never he's got to spare. But I don't care when he takes me in his arms. The world is bright, all right. And what's the difference if I say,
stories like the one about my man, how Flo Ziegfeld imported it and how an artist persuaded him to change his mind about how it should be done, begin to tell us why people in the profession always aspired to work with him. Apparently, he could be swayed, he could be convinced. And he had a style about him that lent kudos to everything he touched, even though the kudos ended up in the bankruptcy court, and one or two of the members of the chorus ended up joining a marginally more exclusive club. Some idea of how even the most distinguished writers and musicians strove to impress Ziegfeld is conveyed by a remarkable story told in his autobiography by P.G. Woodhouse. The story begins back in 1909 when the composer, Jerome Kern, then unknown, writes a melody which he puts away in the bottom drawer and forgets all about. It's a very pleasant, rather wistful little melody, and it goes like this. Seven years after he wrote the song, Kern struck up a partnership with P.G. Woodhouse, who put words to it. Now it sounded like this.
But along came Bill, who's not the type at all. You'd meet him on the street and never notice him. His form and face, his manly grace, are not the kind that you would find in a statue. And I can't explain, it's surely not his brain that makes me. I love him because he is wonderful, because he's just my
But even though it sounded like that, nobody wanted it. Woodhouse and Kern offered it to Marilyn Miller when they were writing Sally for her, but poor Marilyn's judgment of songs was no better than her judgment of the young men who sang them, and she rejected the song. Kern and Woodhouse then decided to perfect a plan to foist the song off on Ziegfeld. They wangled an invitation on board Flo's yacht, made sure there was a lady on board who could sing the song at the drop of a hat, and then made sure that the hat would be dropped. Everything worked like a dream. The song was sung and sounded so good that even Ziegfeld liked it. But there was trouble aboard. The crew were frankly growing mutinous. The ship's cook was fired, but then Ziegfeld had second thoughts and hired him back again, only this time as a kind of culinary stand-in. The cook was, from now on, to live ashore and be fetched on board only to cook terrapin. Meanwhile, what of the song Bill? Ziegfeld offered to buy it for the Follies, but Woodhouse explained that it needed a whole plot to be built round it. Result, stalemate, and apparently the waste of good seaboard intrigue. But not quite. The time came when, in a roundabout way, Ziegfeld money did finance the making of the song, but not for a while yet. A lot more terrapin would have to flow under the bridgework before that happened. There were plenty of other songs which owed at least part of their fame to Ziegfeld's acumen, or luck, or whatever you care to call it. But there was one exception in the early 1920s, a Ziegfeld hit that had already had a long life by the time the Follies audience heard it. In fact, it's a wonder that they didn't sing along with it, because it was already established as the most effective two-handed patter song ever to be written. In 1922, a young opera singer called Nono Otero drifted into Ziegfeld's orbit to find this song on the program.
Well, I auditioned for Florenz Ziegfeld and Ned Wayburn, of course, who produced his shows. And, it was a very frightening experience, as you can imagine, my first audition. I was only 14 years old at the time, and the only professional experience I had had was with the San Carlo Opera Company. And that was not as a soloist, so this was entirely different. Much to my delight, I was chosen to be in the Ziegfeld Follies, which was then going on the road. That was the 1922 Follies, but in the year of 1923, and was making its road tour. And, of course, in the show we had many big stars. And I wore my toe shoes, of course, and I did what I thought was a very lovely toe number for Mr. Ziegfeld. And I wore my most delectable rehearsal outfit. I remember it was a sort of pink satin with a short skirt, and the top was quite fitted, I suppose. Well, there were many others who danced before me, and there were those who danced after me. But I know that I was chosen among the very few to be in this new show. Some of the stars who were going to be traveling on the road, too. Gallagher and Sheen were in that show, were big names at the time, and they were all sitting out front because naturally they wanted to see what the show was going to be like, how it was shaping up and all that sort of thing.
Oh, Miss Agatha.
Hello.
Miss Agatha.
Mr. Sheen.
I wonder why did you come here alone?
Alone?
You must have something on your mind to leave your wife so far behind. She can't even reach you on the telephone.
You're getting personal, Mr. Sheen. Why, Mr. Sheen, I came here because she treated me so mean. Was your married life all right?
Mine was tight, tight, tight. Look at that black eye, Mr. Gallagher.
Look at this one, Mr. Sheen.
Oh, Mr. Gallagher.
Yes, hello.
Mr. Gallagher.
Well, well.
When you sail home, you'll get a great surprise.
I will.
When your ship is drawing near, it will make you shed a tear to see the lights of New York shining in the sky.
You're right, Mr. Sheen. Mr. Sheen, I have made that trip, so I know just what you mean. But there's one light that shines so bright. It's the brightest light in sight.
Statue of Liberty, Mr. Gallagher.
Coney Island, Mr. Sheen.
I suppose Mr. Gallagher and Mr. Sheehan sums up as well as any one song can the essence of Flo Ziegfeld's achievements in taking the spirit of burlesque and music hall and elevating it to the level of authentic revue. In fact, as the 1920s moved on, so did Ziegfeld. Gradually away from the formula of a string of acts doing their own bits and pieces, towards the hinterland of musical comedy and even full-blown, and perhaps slightly overblown, operetta. And that was how that little unwanted song of Kern and Woodhouse finally ended up under his control. In 1925, a bestseller by the novelist Edna Ferber swept across middlebrow America, and before long ended up in the hands of librettist, lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. Johnny Mercer takes up the story.
Showboat was the first big musical comedy of its kind. Now, maybe it wasn't the first one, but it was the biggest. We had come from operettas like Vagabond King, and things with very romantic storylines and florid musical melodies. Very hard for me to say what I'm thinking, but Showboat had some dramatic value, besides a great score and marvelous lyrics, I thought, by Hammerstein. It had a great lot of stars in it, five or six big stars. Charlie Wininger, Edna Mae Oliver, Helen Morgan. That's beside the two leads. I think Showboat was the first demarcation from light operetta. It had things about the Civil War. It had a runaway slave. It had a guy who drank. It was a very dramatic story. It had all these great tunes. Every time you turn around, there'd be a great Kern tune coming out at you. And it was really quite a marvelous show.
Showboat may have been one of the biggest hits that Ziegfeld or any other impresario ever laid hands on, but the truth is that at first the great Ziegfeld lost his nerve. Showboat was a little too serious, a little too ambitious perhaps, for a management that had specialized in W.C. Fields and his warped billiard cues, surrounded by young ladies dressed immaculately in gloves and hats and not much else. Showboat was ready to go in 1926, but Ziegfeld, who had already used the excuse that his other production, Rio Rita, was still doing business, kept delaying the opening. Eventually, Kern and Hammerstein pressured him so hard that he had to open, and he found himself sitting on a gold mine.
Old man river, that old man river, he must know something. But don't say nothing, he just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton, and them that plants 'em is soon forgotten. But old man river, he just keeps rolling along. You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge, lift that gale, get a little drunk and you'll land in jail. I get weary and sick of trying. I'm tired of living and scared of dying. But old man river, he just keeps rolling along.
Old man river, that old man And strain, body all aching and racked with pain.
So that bar,
lift that veil.
We gets a little drunk and we lands in jail. I gets weary and sick of trying. I'm tired of living and scared of dying. By Old Man River, he just keeps rolling
When Johnny Mercer was giving us a rundown of the plot of Showboat a few minutes ago, he left out the character of Julie. She's the one who comes on hard times and ends up as a nightclub singer. Now, that means that when you see her actually singing in the nightclub, the song that she sings doesn't have to fit the story of the show, but can be, literally, any old song. And that's what happened. Kern, whose partnership with Woodhouse had ended some time before, remembered the song that they'd tried to sell Ziegfeld, remembered that Flo had liked it, and slipped it into Showboat for Julie to sing in the nightclub. And when Julie was cast, Ziegfeld found himself with another great star, a singer called Helen Morgan.
Fish gonna swim, birds gonna fly, I gonna love one man till I die. Can't help loving that man of mine. Tell me he's that man of mine.
Showboat ran for 2 years and the takings never fell below $50,000 a week. It toured for years and after it finished, it wasn't long before it was revived again. And again, and again. It's become a standard, a classic of the popular musical theatre, and it was just about the only show that Flo Ziegfeld ever had cold feet about. And that was because it was outside the area he was used to operating in. By the late 1920s, at the height of what Scott Fitzgerald called the Jazz Age, Ziegfeld was in fact running two horses in the musical stakes, operetta and revue, and continuing to find the big names and the new talent. One of those new talents was in the Follies the year that Nonno Otero returned to them.
In 27-28, Eddie Cantor was the star of the show. And we had Claire Luce, who was, I think, well-known in England as well. She featured acrobatic dancing, but she did it like no one had ever done it before. She was extremely graceful and very, very beautiful and slender. And in one number, she came down from the ceiling. It seemed the ceiling, of course, it was the proscenium, and down to the stage in a mirror-covered large ball. Now, when it reached the stage, this ball opened up, and she stepped out and did her beautiful number. But on one occasion, we almost had a near calamity, and this was really quite frightening, because the thing didn't open. And there was just nothing that could be done about it. We were just watching this thing, and everyone was petrified and thought, well, she's just going to die of asphyxiation, surely. But fortunately, it finally did open and saved the day somehow.
I was appearing in Paris at the Casino de Paris, and I'd had a certain success. Miss Dinguette was very annoyed with me because I had certain reviews from the Paris press and left the play, the review, and Volterra, Leon Volterra, a great producer in France, said, you will do her numbers. And I was thrilled to death to appear for the first time in Paris and do the great Miss Dinguette's numbers down the staircase with all the paradise blooms and all that. Ziegfeld heard about it, and someone through some grapevine said, Ziegfeld's in Paris, you know, he may come to see you. And that night, Ziegfeld appeared in the theater, and I fell on the stage. One of the showgirls had dropped a bead or something, and I slid on it, right on my little fanny. Now my ankle began to swell. At the end of the play, of course, I rushed into the dressing room, stuck my foot up in the basin, poured cold water over it, and there was a knock on the door, and as I stood there like that, in came the great Ziegfeld. I was so nervous, I started to speak in French. Entrez, monsieur. Oh, voulez-vous vous asseoir, monsieur? He said, when you get back to New York, Miss Luce, come and see me. And I thought, is that all? I mean, there's no offer there. But I said, I certainly shall, Mr. Ziegfeld. And with that, he just simply disappeared. And when I got back, I went to see him. And he said, I want you to do this number and that number. And I said, well, do I have any say about what I want to do? And he said, yes, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to do this number and I want to do that number. And he always let me do anything I wanted to do, to have anything I wanted. For instance, you know the Telestar, like the ball of mirrors. That I had in the Ziegfeld Follies. I had the original, came down from the ceiling, blinded everybody, of course, and I danced on this huge mirror as it opened. Sensational. But Ziegfeld let me have it.
Ziegfeld let Claire Luce have it in more ways than one when that ball failed to open. But there was something else about the 1927-28 edition of the Follies that's worth mentioning. Stanley Green makes the point for us.
He seldom had any one writer do the entire score, except I think for the 1927 Follies, which Berlin did do the entire score. Another thing was that he never starred anybody above the title. It was originally done as Follies of with the year, and then through the years it became Ziegfeld Follies.
Ziegfeld at this time, the middle and later 1920s, was riding as high as any showman ever had in history. His shows were on all over the place, very often vying with each other at the box office. Revue and operetta became his twin provinces, and although the audiences never noticed it, sometimes the stars were singing the tenderest love songs to each other, while all the time they detested each other. And that's one thing Nono Otero couldn't forget.
When I was in The Three Musketeers, Dennis King sang the main part of D'Artagnan in that, and Vivian Siegel, and I was a dancer in it. And I must tell you, I had a terrible crush on Dennis King at the time. Of course, he didn't know that. I just stood in the wings, you know, and owed and awed at him. He was very, very handsome. But what was going on stage, which the public really didn't know, was a feud going on between Dennis King and Vivian Siegel, the prima donna, which was really quite amusing to the cast because they would sort of bump into each other at odd times because they had this little thing going, you know, and they were getting back at each other. I don't think the audience was ever aware, but it was an amusing thing to the cast in any event.
Amusing indeed for the cast, I should think, as Nono Otero said, but then there were other human interest problems. Sometimes the dancer fell in love not with one of the cast, but with one of the backroom boys. Claire Luce confesses all.
I fell in love with Irving Berlin in the Music Box Review. It was unrequited. He was in love with the lady that he married and is married to now, but I fell in love with Irving. And I used to weep on Fanny's shoulder. Oh, I loved him. I still love him. In fact, I talked to him a few months ago on the telephone. I said, did you know that I always loved you? He said, why didn't you tell me so? I must tell this story on him because it shows what a little hick I was during rehearsals. I said to Irving, is it all right? Do you like this dance? It was a cat dance or something, whatever it was called. And he said, yes, yes, he said, you know, you have sex appeal. And I said, what's that? I mean it. I was very young. And he said, well, he said, that's just a quality that makes every man in the theater want to go to bed with you. I said, oh, how horrible. And I rushed to Fanny. I said, Mr. Berlin just insulted me. And she said, why, really? I can't imagine he wouldn't. I told her the story. She said, oh, what an insult, she said. You act as if it's some kind of a disease. I wish I had it. Then she looked in the mirror and made a little face and said, as a matter of fact, I do.
Morning, I'll be getting up. Morning, I'll be setting up a tiny table. He's grateful. He eats a big plateful, and he faints right after breakfast for the one he loves.
Although Ziegfeld didn't suspect it, the sands were running out for him, even as Showboat and the Three Musketeers and the Follies and all the rest of the super productions were pulling them in. Indeed, time was running short for the whole of America. When the 1929 crash came and caught every stockbroker in the country with his trousers down, Ziegfeld was wiped out. And although his reputation and his productions remained in the forefront of attention for another decade, things were never really the same for him. Keenan Wynn goes some way to explaining why.
You know, he was a very extravagant man. He had three shows going at one time. He had the Three Musketeers and Whoopi and, I don't know, Rosalie. He had three of them going at one time, and he was breaking even, which is pretty impossible, you know. 1927, 28, before the crash.
And what about after the crash? Did Flo pull in his horns and start living on a shoestring, say, on $500,000 a year? No, apparently not.
When my father and he were in partnership on Simple Simon, Mr. Ziegfeld went to Palm Beach. And my father was in charge of the box office and everything else because he had been an actor manager before with his own show. And Mr. Ziegfeld sent a frantic telegram. You've probably heard stories. They always sent lengthy telegrams. And he said, Eddie, I must have $4,000 immediately. Desperate kind of a telegram. So my father went to the box office and took $4,000 out in cash. Now, this is just when the crash was beginning. You know, it started in 1929. He sent the $4,000 in a money order to Palm Beach, and Mr. Ziegfeld took a private railroad car back to New York.
Well, they don't make skinflints like that anymore, and I bet that the bank managers of this world are pretty glad about that. And next week, we follow the Ziegfeld story literally through to the death. We trace our steps to see what happened to his love life, his marriage and his family, and try to work out exactly how he managed to go on producing mammoth shows. It was once said of someone else, but it could equally apply to Flo Ziegfeld, that he didn't want to be a millionaire, he just wanted to live like one. Well, that he did, and next week we'll see how the trick was done. Perhaps he deserved to get away with it after all. I mean, people went to his shows and came out feeling happy, and that was something. And they heard this kind of music, and that was something too.